This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, we talk with Benji Project founder Cynthia Osterman and child psychologist Dr. Alexa Murphy about the results of a survey of local teams on the psychological effects of the COVID-19 pandemic and about things adults can do to help teens in crisis. So now, let's go inside the Compass. It seems strangely appropriate that it was on a day that would shatter heat records across the Pacific Northwest that I sat down on a bench in the shade of a tree at the Mountain View Commons with Benji Project founder and board president Cynthia Osterman, along with board member and child psychologist Dr. Alexa Murphy, about the challenges faced by local teams in the time of pandemic and other global threats.
The subject today is a survey that has been done by the Benji Project during the pandemic to assess the effects of the pandemic on teens in Port Townsend. And so I gather you were sort of the founder, Lex, of the survey?
Yeah, well, Cynthia and I are on a couple of different working groups in Jefferson County that have been trying to mount a response or better understand the needs for teens in the context of the stressors of the pandemic. And one of the limitations involved is that we don't have updated data for how teens are doing in our county. So the CDC conducts a healthy youth survey every 2 years on anxiety, depression, suicidality. And the last time it was distributed was 2018. It was scrapped in 2020. So in the winter of 2020 going into 2021, there was concern that we didn't have updated data, which made it hard to figure out what an appropriate response would be. So it was Cynthia's idea to conduct the same survey that the CDC would have done using those items, but to be able to take up that task as part of the Benji Project and Be Healthy Jefferson and do it ourselves, which is what we did in spring this year at Port Townsend High and Chimicum High.
Okay, well, so before we get into the results of that survey, I would like to ask you, Cynthia. I understand you can't be here that long, so I'd like to get a little bit of background history. I mean, what is the Benji Project and how did it get started?
The Benji Project was founded in 2017 in memory of my son, Benji Kenworthy, who died at age 15 of suicide. That was in 2015, and obviously that was a traumatic event for our family and a real turning point in my life. And I went on a journey trying to understand how he could have reached that point without my noticing. And I learned a lot about adolescent psychology and brain development and impulsivity. And it became really important to me to address what I saw as an unmet need in our county, to give all kids, whether they're highly functioning or they're struggling, tools to better cope with the challenges that come with everyday life. And even when things are going well, it's stressful. So kids who, sometimes the kids who have the most mental health burdens are the kids who are most successful. They hold themselves to really tough standards. So I've been a mindfulness meditator for about 25 years and started looking in that world with the assistance of some mental health professionals in the community and learned about the incredible results of a combination of mindfulness and self-compassion. And mindfulness, in one slogan description, is paying attention to the present moment on purpose. And self-compassion is treating yourself with the care that you would give a good friend. And my own personal experience is that self-compassion is really challenging. I think especially in our culture where we direct a lot of really harsh talk towards ourselves. And I know that I had a lot of self-judgment after Benji's death. And studying this has been really transformational for me. And the curriculum has shown really great evidence-based results. So that's what we're offering the teens of Jefferson County.
First, let me just tell you how my heart goes out to you. I mean, that's about the worst thing that can happen, I think, in any person's life is to lose a child.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
I have actually lost a niece to suicide as well.
I'm so sorry.
So I know a little bit about how that feels. And so self-compassion, how do you go about teaching self-compassion?
Well, we use a curriculum. There are mindful self-compassion has been taught as a curriculum since the early 2000s. The kind of conceptual framework was developed by Dr. Kristen Neff, who is at University of Texas, Austin, and Dr. Chris Germer, who's at Harvard Medical School, or he was at the time. And they use this with adults in an 8-week program for many years. And then an adaptation was created under their auspices, specifically for adolescents, because you know, we all know that teenagers feel and think really differently than adults do. So it works on the same concepts, but, you know, approaches them a little differently, more experiential and less abstract than in the adult curriculum.
So let's turn to you, Dr. Alexa, for a moment. Mm-hmm. And, talk about the survey you did and what questions were asked and who was approached.
We asked questions about anxiety symptoms, about depression symptoms, and about markers of suicidality as well. And those came from the CDC survey. Then we were also curious about asking more specific questions related to stressors during the pandemic and coping with the pandemic. So we took a couple items from a survey that had been developed by CAMH in Toronto and had been distributed to high schoolers in Toronto, as well as a research group at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that specializes in traumatic stress. So we asked questions related to how teens self-assessed how they were doing before the pandemic compared to now, asked them to rate how much distress they experienced due to COVID-19, and then we also had an open-ended question where we just asked them to share the effects of the pandemic on themselves and their family, both positive and negative.
And what did you find?
Good question. So compared to the survey results in 2018, and I should say that an important caveat is that our methods differed, right? So the way that the CDC does surveys in schools pre-pandemic would be to have all the 10th graders in a classroom sit down and answer the survey in person. So from 2018, there were 120 students who participated. We obviously had the challenge of lockdown and kids not being in schools, so we partnered with 10th grade teachers at Port Townsend and Chimicum who added the survey link to their Google playlist. So we had fewer participants. We had 53, but still a good amount that we were proud of. And what we found is that compared to 2018, anxiety and depression symptoms were relatively unchanged, really equivalent levels, yeah, in terms of the percentage of students who endorsed significant symptoms of anxiety and depression. Also pretty similar levels of suicidality, so in terms of thoughts about suicide, having made a plan about suicide, or having attempted suicide in the past year. And there was even a hint that that number might be trending downwards a little bit compared to 2018.
Did those results surprise you?
If I can put them in context of what suicide researchers are finding nationally and globally right now, they didn't surprise me as much. So early in 2020, during the lockdown, there was a lot of concern about, you know, I think some of the quotes from the New York Times and other publications were tidal waves or tsunamis of suicidality that would be impacting adults and youth in 2020. And there were reasons to suspect that, given that we were coming at the end of a 13-year stretch in the U.S. where rates of suicide increased every year. We also were seeing a lot of increase in risk factors for suicidality related to hopelessness and isolation in lockdowns. However, the CDC is still compiling data, but what we've seen is that the rates of deaths by suicide in 2020 actually decreased. There were lower numbers. And I think it's going to take a while for us to parse that apart. But in general, the story that's being told around that data is that there was an increased awareness of mental health and also a push to distribute and disseminate crisis resources nationally, especially during early months of the lockdown. And we've also seen record numbers of people call into crisis hotlines. So it seems that even though risk factors may have increased, it seems that more people were utilizing crisis resources and fewer people died by suicide nationally last year. And also, as we've been sort of talking about what this might mean more locally, we also talked about, you know, in the context of lockdown, teens are home and there's increased monitoring and supervision, so that there might also be a little bit more awareness about what's happening with teens as well.
We've done sessions with educators and healthcare providers, and you know, we hear from some educators anecdotally that their impressions of how teens are doing are much worse. You know, so we've done a lot of speculation about, you know, were the kids who responded to the survey, you know, the kids who were coping better, or maybe the kids who were coping worse because they more felt a need to express what was going on. So, you know, there's really a lot of limitations to what we can infer from the data.
Well, of course, one of the characteristics of depression is an incapacity to act. So I could see where if there was some initiation required on the part of the teen in order to participate in the survey, and there was less than half the participation this time. I mean, that alone could be an indicator of depression.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's important to think about who was high-functioning enough to access Google playlists on a weekly basis in the context of remote school.
Also, you know, we don't know. It was such an unprecedented event. We don't know what post-lockdown will look like. So we don't know if, you know, this will have a kind of rebound effect in the coming year. Certainly, I think the mental health needs of our teens locally will continue to be as great or greater than they have been.
Were there reports of positive effects of the pandemic?
You know, we asked teens to rate on a scale of 1 to 10 how much distress they experienced due to the pandemic. And, man, we got a range of responses everywhere from 1 to 10 different students endorsed. The average was 5, right in the middle. So for us, it helped us think that there's really a range of ways to experience the stress related to the pandemic. And then we also asked students to rate how they felt now compared to before the pandemic. About 43% said they felt worse now compared to before the pandemic, that their mental health was worse. But the majority did say that they felt the same or better than before the pandemic. And then we really enjoyed reading some of the open-ended responses that teens were willing to share with us. And I think most frequently what came up was the impact of school closures. Some people had a really hard time with that. They talked about feeling really isolated from their friends. One person said they felt like they had lost themselves, given how much they were removed from their daily activities. Other people said that it was, quote, the single best thing that happened to my mental health was to be able to do school at home and to have more flexibility in that way. Teens also talked about growing closer to their family in the context of spending more time together. So for us, those open-ended responses were really illuminating and painted a picture that there was no one way to respond to this, that there were a plurality of responses.
And because we were really curious to hear more from teens, and also we wanted to make it easier for community members to connect with what teens were experiencing, we did a video in which teens just talked about their experiences, so no attempt to be, you know, representative of the whole population. And that video is available on our website, www.thebenjiproject.org. Benji's with a J. It's very moving. You know, kids really had a range of experiences and certainly lots of difficulty, but there was also lots of resilience and growth there too. I'm constantly blown away by how thoughtful and resourceful adolescents are. And I feel like during the pandemic, teenagers kind of fell out of sight for a lot of people, especially those people who don't have teenagers in their lives. And I would urge all community members to think about the teenagers around them, especially with our older average age population. it's important that we all take care of one another, and if there's a teenager in your neighborhood or in your church, or you see on your daily walks, just give some thought to them and see if you can be empathetic ear or a support system for them. Some kids don't have good support at home.
Having lived through the very traumatic experience that you lived through, I'm sure that you have spent a huge amount of time looking back and, wondering what you might have done differently, what you might have done better. What advice do you have for parents of teenagers in that regard?
I'm no expert in this area. I can only talk about my own experience. I think, one of the things that became very clear to me with my son Benji was that from social media and the fact that he was just always a really sensitive kid, he felt this very strong need to present an image that everything was fine, that he was coping and he was handling it, and even to the extent that he didn't want to share that with his family. And part of what led me on this journey was trying to understand why. And I think that many teens, challenge is not normalized in our culture. Many teenagers, and many adults for that matter, think that normal is to be happy and successful, and, what you see on Facebook is how it is for most people. And, anyone who's lived into their late 20s knows that ups and downs are just normal, and it's our ability to just get back on our feet and keep on going, and better days will surely come. I think that for teenagers, their lifespan has been short, and it's hard to see that cycle of ups and downs when you are just on the verge of adulthood. So I would say that both for teens and for adults, it's really important for us to get comfortable with the idea of dropping the mask and showing our vulnerabilities to one another. I think once we acknowledge our struggles and our successes and how we feel about ourselves, we can start talking about these things. I know that for me, that self-compassion piece and being able to say that I failed as a parent in certain respects has been huge for me to grow beyond it.
Have you got any advice for parents about how to recognize signs of difficulty?
I guess I'm thinking about, what can parents do? My research background is working with families of children with cancer and moving alongside families experiencing that specific traumatic event. And, the message that we had for parents in those communities is that it's okay to prioritize your mental health. I think often when a family is experiencing a traumatic event, parents think the most loving thing is to ignore how they're doing and really just focus on being there for their child. And no matter what community you're working with, the best predictor of teen mental health is parent mental health. So we used to use the oxygen mask analogy. Like, it's okay to put your own oxygen mask on first and to take care of yourself. In some ways, that's the most loving thing that you can do for your child. And I think the other thing that's important is, there's signs and symptoms related to withdrawal or, changing in school and social habits, but often there's no signs or symptoms. Sometimes there's really not a lot of ways to know the nature of depression and suicidality is that sometimes it's quite secretive, and sometimes there's a lot of shame and a lot of masking about how you're doing. So the best thing to do is not to wait for the signs and symptoms, but to ask. So I have been talking to parents around, how do you ask those questions? Saying, it's this far into the pandemic. Some people are doing really great. Some people are having a hard time. How are you doing? The other thing that's important to know is that research shows that there is no harm in asking teens about whether or not they're having thoughts about not wanting to be alive anymore. And often it's really important to ask that question directly. And this can be true for parents and for other adults who have caring relationships with teens. It's okay to ask that question. Often it's a relief to be asked that question.
It's also important to recognize that more so with any other age group and suicide, there's a lot of impulsivity with teens. I know that was a big factor for Benji. The day was going along like any other, and I thought he'd gone out for a walk. You know, there was no kind of big, you know, break or upset before. And so keeping the means away from teens, like, you know, making sure that there are either no guns in your house or that guns are locked up or that you're, you know, kind of aware where your kid is at all times. I think that those are important things to, you know, because if you can get them through that moment, things will probably feel really different to them the next day or later that day.
Right. I mean, I know in the case of my niece, there was a gun in the house and she used it. And she'd had a bad and embarrassing experience and did not reach out to her sister, to whom she was very close, did not reach out to anybody. And I think one of the things that everybody in the family thought afterwards was, did we do enough to, like, just keep an open door, you know, and make the plea, you know, if you're ever feeling in a certain way, mm-hmm. please call me. Recognizing that you have people who love you is really important.
Yeah, I count myself very lucky because the last interaction I had with Benji, I was giving him a big hug and telling him how much I love him. So, you know, I didn't know that would be the last time, but I feel very grateful for that.
I was talking to a young woman recently who struggles sometimes with depression. I mean, or rather, you know, like, describes a feeling of just sort of flat affect, just like not depression maybe, but not any kind of emotion. And because of climate change in particular, has a sense of there not being a future, really. And has real trouble in terms of, like, making career decisions and so on, because they just seem like nonsense to her. And, you know, and I was asking her if she ever thought of harming herself or had suicidal thoughts. And she says, no, I don't think about harming myself or suicide so much, but I do think, really, am I going to go on for another 50 years this way? So any advice for that young woman?
Yeah, you know, when I think about risk factors or drivers of depression or anhedonia or suicidality, I'm thinking about isolation, I'm thinking about thoughts of burdensomeness, but I'm also thinking about hopelessness. And I have heard this from other young people that I work with, that one of the drivers for hopelessness is the state of the world, you know? And I come from a cognitive behavioral training background where I think about thoughts, I think about behaviors, think about what's malleable. It's hard to challenge that worldview, right? That we shouldn't feel hopeless about climate change, that we shouldn't feel hopeless about the political landscape that we find ourselves in. But what I think is important to pivot to is, so what do you do with your one precious life, right? Is there a way to live dialectically where we accept that we're living in a moment of many different political and global and climate crises, and there are spaces where we can feel empowered to make change locally in our community, nationally, globally? And can we live with both of those truths at once, that it feels hopeless right now? We're sitting in the middle of a heat wave, right? And that there are still some things that I can do to make change. And can we sit with both of those truths at once? Can we live dialectically in that way?
So in the survey, I understand you asked teens to whom they would turn if they were feeling distress. Then I'd be interested in knowing the results of that.
About a quarter of teens said that they had no one to talk to. And a really small amount responded that there would be an adult in their life that they would turn to. Only one student said there was an adult in their school. 12% said an adult friend or relative. 4% said a religious or a faith leader. So the majority of teens that were in this survey did not say that there was an adult that they would turn to for help. So to me, as an adult and as a child psychologist, I think that this is really a call to action for our community members, caring adults in the community, be they parents, teachers, counselors, or if you're listening, if you just know a teen, that it's really our job to pick this up, and it's our job to start this conversation with teens. If teens are telling us that they don't feel comfortable reaching out to us, then that means that we need to reach out to them and ask directly how they're doing and how they're coping, and if they're in crisis, how we can partner with them through it.
And how do teens reach out to the Benji Project, for example, or what other resources are there?
So the Benji Project is offering two summer camps, one for middle school-aged children, which is full, and another one for teens called Mindfulness in Motion, and there's still spots available. The summer camp is in July, and it's a teen-led mindfulness program that explores mindfulness through motion, including using moves from boxing. So you can go to the website and sign up for that if you're listening and interested. I also think it's important to talk about, you know, how we have conversations with teens about difficult topics. So being really directive about asking how they're doing, and again, not being afraid to ask directly, have you been having thoughts about not wanting to be alive anymore? May I share a couple of crisis resources to think about as well? So one is the Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is a national lifeline for teens and adults, 1-800-273-8254. And then one crisis resource that teens are using more and more and might prefer is a crisis text line, as opposed to talking on the phone, texting. And to initiate that, you just text HOME, H-O-M-E, to 741-741. And to also reiterate, you know, what Cynthia said, if you are a parent or if you're living in a home with a teen, you know, a specific feature of teen mental health is impulsivity. You know, teens' brains are developed to feel emotions so strongly. The prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain that can sort of dampen those emotions or bring online more sophisticated coping skills, doesn't fully develop until you're in your 20s. So teens have this interesting dichotomy where they're really set up to have these strong emotions, but not as well prepared to regulate them as well. So given that, we really need parents and adults to partner with teens to move through those crisis moments and to also keep their environment safe. So one of my favorite resources is locktolive.org, lock2live.org, which walks adults and teens through how to make sure that their home is safe so that teens can ride out those crisis movements without having the means accessible to harm themselves.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much for taking the time today. And I'm sorry to say Cynthia Osterman had to leave earlier, but this is Steve Evans, and I have been talking to Cynthia Osterman, founding board member of the Benji Project, and with Dr. Lexa Murphy. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having us. We appreciate it.
This week's Compass is written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Saturdays at noon and repeats on Mondays at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ Live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.